Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
What if writing a really big number didn't mean adding zeros, but drawing a picture of a god, for example? And what if at some point numbers just stopped working? Today, we're joined by Richard Elwes, who invites us into the wonderfully weird world of unimaginably large numbers. In his new book, Huge Numbers, A Story of Counting Ambitiously from 4.5 to Fish 7, we meet numerical giants so big you couldn't write them down if you used every particle in the universe, and concepts so strange they almost feel like science fiction. It's a journey through history, math, and the limits of human imagination. And trust me, Richard's going to get delightfully out of hand. Richard Elwes, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I need to start with something that I think a lot of people aren't aware of. This thing that we go to on a daily basis, sometimes many, many times in a day, this thing called Google.
That was based on a math concept or a very, very large number. And Googology, the study of very large numbers.
Yeah, Googology is the study of large numbers. So my book is really all about Googology. That's right. Google the number is... that's one followed by 100 zeros, so that's 10 to the 100. It's spelled differently, actually, so it's Google rather than Google, the search engine. But I think, I might be wrong, but I think the search engine may have taken their name from the enormous number, which came first. It was invented by a nine-year-old boy, actually, that name, the Google.
The Google, the G-O-O-G-O-L, was invented by a nine-year-old boy?
Yeah, so he was called Milton Sirota, and he was interested in very big numbers, and he thought, oh, if I put a one followed by 100 zeros, that's a really, really big number. So he came up with this name, Google, for it, and that's why the study of huge numbers is called Googology. But I guess it gets sort of a little bit spicier with the next step, which is where... you take a one and then put a Google zeros after it. And then you're really into the realms of numbers, which are sort of far beyond anything you need in, you know, physics or any sort of conventional human activity. And that number is called a Googleplex. And that's, I think that's in the Guinness Book of Records for the largest number with a widely accepted name, the Googleplex.
A Googleplex, okay. Well, Richard, I have to be honest with you. When I was a young girl, I would have these nightmares, and they were about infinite numbers, huge numbers. And it was as though I was put in a room and I had to count all of these numbers that could be items of this Googleplex number of things. And so huge numbers, as you know, they've always been a little scary to me. But how did you get interested in huge numbers?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think they do have this sort of, if not necessarily fear, at least a sort of feeling of awe of when there's just, the number is just bigger than anything you could reasonably get a handle on. I think that's quite a common reaction. I think it's a slightly feeling of vertigo. I got interested in it. I think there were still two separate routes which came together. And then I realized that this was a thing I was interested in. One is that I've always had an interest in the history of maths. I mean, I'm not a historian by training. I'm a mathematician, but I've always had an interest in the history of the subject. And you mentioned earlier in the introduction that the ancient Egyptians had a writing system where the numbers just literally run out. For most purposes, a million was the biggest number they could write. Okay, you could put a few millions together and maybe got as far as 10 million. But if you want to go bigger than that, they just didn't have any way of writing it down because each number, 10, 100, 1,000, had its own symbol and they just hadn't invented symbols. And so I realized that, you know, that's actually quite a fundamental thing about their numeral system, which is radically different, of course, to the one we're used to. Whereas we don't actually run out at any point, right? You could put as many zeros after your initial one as you like. Of course, it starts to become impractical once they get longer and longer. But nevertheless, it doesn't sort of cap out. So there's a sort of theoretical difference between the two numeral systems as to how big a number they can handle before they break down. So that was one angle, the sort of historical angle. And then the other angle was closer to my work as a mathematician. So my background is mathematical logic. And very, very big numbers play a surprising role in mathematical logic as well. This is quite a recent thing. So over the last sort of 50 years or so, we've discovered sequences of numbers which grow so fast that they completely overpower anything you might try to use to write it down very, very quickly. But it's not just about writing it down, actually. They have sort of logical implications for our fundamental axioms which underlie arithmetic. So there's sort of two very different angles, sort of modern mathematical logic and ancient history. And I realize there's something in common there, right? It's about how big a number our systems can handle. And I thought that was quite an interesting confluence.
If you're just joining me on Cool Science Radio, I'm having a conversation with mathematical logician Richard Elwes. He's talking to us about his new book called Huge Numbers, in which he explains how humans have long struggled to describe and understand quantities that stretch beyond everyday experience. Okay, Richard, what is fish 7?
I wish you'd asked me what 4.5 was first. That's easier to answer.
Let me ask that first. I mean, actually, I was going to ask you why 4.5 was even in the tagline, because that seems simple, but somehow it's not.
Well, it is simple. It's 4.5. I mean, my tongue slightly in my cheek. I'm arguing it's the first big number. And the reason for that is it's a place where a human system for handling numbers breaks down. And that system is the most basic one we have. It's cognitive scientists call it subitizing. It's basically being able to recognize a number just by seeing it. So if I put 3 marbles on the table, you will immediately recognize it as 3, right? Whereas if I put 9 marbles on the table, you might get it wrong. You might think there's 8 or 10 or 11 or whatever. And to get it right, you'll have to stop and count. But 3, you don't have to stop and count. And 4.5 is... Okay, why is it 4.5? Because the guy who did the original experiment, William Stanley Jevons in the 19th century, he realized he was getting right every time for 4 and most of the time for 5. And he said, okay, 4.5, we'll say that's the limit of this system. So it's the first point where a human numerical system breaks down. And that's why I thought, it's a nice place to start the story of big numbers, because in some sense, any number beyond that is big in the sense of defeating that sort of most ingrained number system that we have. If you want to deal with bigger numbers than that, then you have to count. And actually counting is a much more complex thing than we give it credit for. There are plenty of people around in the world living in indigenous societies who don't have a system which will allow them to count as large as they might want to go. So, yeah, that's why 4.5. Fish 7?
That's so interesting. So is that... let me just ask you about 4.5. So is that to say that one should never have more than 4 children, because you might just lose one of them? you can't count them. And I ask that, I'm also tongue in cheek, but I'm wondering if it then, where our the point at which our numerical system breaks down, but is that about cognition and the ability to see, maybe a visual skill more than it is numerical?
It's not just visual, that, because they've done similar experiments based on numbers of sounds and things. And actually, it's quite a hard limit. It's not specific to one particular sense. So it's a cognitive limit. And I think it's interesting because it's the point where below that number, 1, 2, 3, 4, you don't have to learn anything, right? It's completely instinctive. You don't have to be taught this is 2, that's 3. There are lots of animals around the animal kingdom who can distinguish 2 from 3, for example. They don't have words for it. They don't have symbols for it. It's not something they've learned. Baby chickens can do it from just, a day or two old to distinguish 2 from 3. Right. So this is a very, very inbuilt thing. And this is somehow where our number sense starts. If you want to take anything beyond that, then you need learnt skills. So counting is, you know, it's a social construct. It's something we teach our children. We've developed it over the centuries. It's a much more complicated thing than people realize, particularly a numeral system like the one we're used to, where you can basically push it as high as you want. And the only real limit is you'll run out of time, right? If you want to count to a million. There is a guy who counted to a million once. It took him, I think, several months. But that's the limit, right? You run out of time.
Was that guy just newly retired or something? He didn't quite know what to do with himself.
I don't know what motivated him. He did video himself doing it. I'm going to say he wasn't newly retired because he looked quite young, but I don't know what his motivation was. I think it might have been a sponsored thing for charity, I think.
Yeah. Wow. That's pretty mind-boggling. Okay, so as a mathematical logician, you're a professor, but
how else do you apply this type of knowledge?
Going through your world.
So I'm interested in mathematical logic, but I think there are two types of logician, really. There are people who just study the logic because it seems interesting, and there are those who want to see what it tells us about mathematics more broadly. And I put myself in the second category. I don't find that the sort of things I study and learn are useful to me outside of teaching and research. But it is about engaging with other branches of mathematics, and in particular, searching for bits of mathematics which people might not have realized are interesting from a logical point of view as well as from a sort of broader mathematical point of view. And there are big numbers which feature in these sorts of questions, sort of quite simple sounding puzzles which you can explain, and then the answer is just some unfathomably enormous number. And the reasons for that are to do with the underlying logic of the sort of mathematical system you're working in, which is, no, it's I find that stuff quite attractive as well.
Okay, well then let us go into Fish 7 with that in mind. What is Fish 7 as a huge number?
Well, so Fish 7 is the biggest number which appears in my book, Huge Numbers. And it was invented a few years ago, I'm going to say maybe 10 years ago, I can't remember exactly, by a Japanese Googologist who writes under the pseudonym Fish. That's why it's called Fish, because he writes under the name Fish. And this was his seventh number. Okay, so it's Fish's seventh number. That's what the name comes from. As to what it actually is, I mean, it was an attempt to simply write down the biggest number that anyone had ever written down. That it's got no sort of inherent meaning beyond just trying to be enormous. And there was a big number competition, which was held in 2007 between two logicians in MIT. And they challenged each other, Adam Elgar and Augustin Rao, they challenged each other to who could write down the biggest number. And what's quite interesting about that competition is that once you start thinking about that, you realize that you need to devise more and more powerful mathematical tools to describe numbers. So it's actually a surprisingly enlightening thing to do, because you're developing more and more powerful mathematical technology to describe bigger and bigger numbers. And technology which also has applications in other places. So one example is a Turing machine, which is a theoretical model of a computer, essentially, predating the physical computer. It's a theoretical model of computation. And when explained exactly, but you can ask questions along the general lines of, if you put some sort of constraint on the Turing machine, how many sort of bits it's allowed, what's the biggest number you can make it produce? And asking questions like that, you know, what is the biggest number I can generate using this particular piece of technology? And then you trump that by saying, okay, here's an even more powerful piece of technology. What's the biggest number I can produce using that? And so on and so on. And so Rao's number is generally taken to be sort of the biggest number people have come up with. That came out of this 2007 big number competition in MIT. Rayo's number uses a very, very powerful piece of modern mathematical technology called set theory, and basically says it's the biggest number you can write in the language of set theory in a Google symbols. And that is far bigger than anything you could write down using any sort of notational system. If you wanted to write, you know, if you wanted to say 10, sort of winding back down a little bit, if you want to write really, really big numbers, you can say, okay, 10 to the Google is a Googleplex. 10 to the Googleplex, we could say. So 1 followed by Googleplex zeros. And then you say 1 followed by that number of zeros and 1 followed by that number of zeros. And then I could spend the rest of the night saying that, and that would get us somewhere. I mean, all the numbers I'm talking about now, which come out of modern logic, blow all of that way out of the water. I mean, they just far, far beyond anything that you can approach with that. And so Fish 7 was Fish's sort of refinement of Rayo's number, really. An attempt to write down the biggest number anyone had ever come up with, right? And it's really big. I think that's about all anyone can say about it, isn't it? There's nothing else you can use to gauge it, really. It's just far bigger than anything else you could think about.
Oh my goodness, this is so interesting and yet overwhelming, and taking me back to those nightmares of when I was 7 years old and had to count to Fish 7.
Take you a long time.
It's interesting that I was thinking about, you know, how can we bring this conversation home to the average person? And for anyone who's ever visited, been a tourist to the Yucatan area, of Mexico or Central America, like Belize area, Guatemala, and the Mayans. In the Mayans, where there's this Mayan calendar, and it's actually represented as an art piece. Of course, it means nothing to most people who are looking at it, but you do mention this in the book. And I thought it was really interesting. It'd be interesting to ask you about how they contemplated this course of history on the scale of trillions of years. Tell us more about it.
Thank you. And even beyond trillions. That's right. They had we're talking about the classical Mayans who lived in that Yucatan Peninsula between around 250 to the year 900. And they had an extremely strong interest in the passage of time, and they measured it in lots of different ways. They had a whole arsenal of different techniques for measuring passages of time, but the longest running one is something called the Mayan long count, and that dates everything to a sort of mythical day zero, which our scholars have traced back, and they think that's the 11th of August in the year 3114 BC. And they, dating things from that, they had a system which counted mostly in 20s. So they used days, and then they had a sort of month in quotes, which was 20 days. And then they had a year, which was 18 of those months. So 360 day year for this purpose. They had other years as well, incidentally. But for this one, it's a 360 day year called the Tun. And then a 20 year cycle they had that was the Katun. And then 20 of those was a thing called a baktun. And that system of five numbers, the day, the month, the year, the katun and the baktun, is a sort of sequence of five numbers one sees written on Mayan monuments around there. It dates all the monuments from this initial zero date. But in a few places, one sees longer numbers where... So it's not five sequence of five numbers. They're longer, and in fact there's one place in there's a site called Coba where they found monuments which the date is written as 2013s followed by four zeros, right? And if you take that literally, that seems to be describing a time period on the scale of octillions of years, right? Octillions, which is 10 to the 27, so one followed by 27 zeros, right? So this is enormously bigger than the lifetime of the universe as we understand it in modern physics. And so they had an interest in timescales on this sort of scale, which is remarkable, really, because very few other people did or do.
Well, I know that the Mayans is an ancient civilization. Were they just
intellectually superior? How do you, as a mathematician, look at these?
You know, how do you consider these people that contemplated those sorts of things?
It is awe-inspiring. I think one thing it's important to say is that they were able to do this because they developed a very powerful way of writing down numbers. So mm-hmm. they developed place value notation, which is what we've got today. So what place value notation means is if I write down the number 77, those two sevens mean different things, right? Depending on, it's not just the symbol, it's also where it is, because the first seven means seven tens. And the Mayans developed place value notation, which, you know, for us, that's just normal. That's how we write numbers. But actually, ancient people generally failed to find it. So you think of the Roman Empire, they made do with Roman numerals, which were mm-hmm. enormously inferior ways of writing numbers. Mm. And likewise, the ancient Greeks, who, you know, very famous for their mathematical progress, but actually they didn't have a number system, anything like as efficient or as either the one we use today, which originally developed in India, or the Mayan one. So I think it was really that piece of technology allowed them to then start writing, you know, far bigger numbers than anyone else could, because you don't have to have special symbols or special names if you've got place value notation. You can just write long sequences of numbers. So it's a very freeing piece of technology, which they really made the most of, and they sort of weaved all their myths and legends and religious beliefs out of these enormous numbers, all made possible by place value notation, which is such an important part of the modern world as well.
Yeah. Well, also in your book, Huge Numbers, you tell a story of modern history, more modern history, and this is the devaluation from hyperinflation of a currency, the Hungarian pengo, I think it's called. You know, there was a hyperinflation crisis following World War II. Tell us about that devaluation of that currency. Again, a huge number.
Yes. So, I mean, there have been quite a few instances of hyperinflation. And it's such a terrible financial disaster. I mean, it basically renders all your money worthless if the if the value plummets so quickly. It's an enormous disaster. And the Hungarian hyperinflation just after World War II was, I think, the most extreme hyperinflation that's ever been measured. And there's quite a lot of competition. The most famous case is probably the mark before World War II, which probably the damage that did to the German economy was widely seen as playing a role in the rise of Nazism and the start of the war. But after the World War II, the Hungarian pengo went the same way, and I think the annualized inflation rate did hit a Google, I think. So it didn't run that for a whole year, but it hit levels where if you were to sort of extrapolate from that period of time to a year, it was at a Google annual percent inflation, which is astonishing. But it essentially meant that this currency plummeted to effectively zero value, and they managed to end this hyperinflation. Well, there were two things. One is that they got back the gold reserves, which had been looted during the war. Mm-hmm. And so that restored some sort of economic stability. And then they reintroduced a different currency, the forint. And effectively, I mean, in truth, what happened was that they just discarded the pengo. They just sort of put it in the bin and said, this is useless. But there was a nominal exchange rate to the new currency, which I think was again measured in octillions. I think it was a few octillion pengo were one forint.
Yeah, go ahead and exchange 400 quadrillion or four. Was it 4 × 10⁻⁹ for one forint?
Yeah, right.
That's a lot. That is some buying power. Well, it's tragic. It's really tragic, but it's also very interesting. And it shows the value, you know, of knowing about these large numbers. This is such an interesting topic and surprising as well. Well, Richard Elwes, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. The book is called Huge Numbers, A Story of Counting Ambitiously. from 4.5 to fish 7. And we all know what 4.5 and fish 7 signify when we're talking about numbers. So, Richard, thank you so much for joining me on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been really fun.